Good afternoon.
May it please the court. Doug Correct, registration number 33347 for appellant Connell Resources. This case, although admittedly somewhat factually complex, has a very simple legal test. The law of the case is clear. Issues of disputed fact are for the jury, not the judge. Here, the trial court made itself both the judge and the jury on three of Connell's most central claims. In doing so, the trial court improperly deprived Connell of one of its most basic rights in the civil justice system, a full and a fair jury trial. The court's rulings on Connell's directed verdicts were in error, and we respectfully request that they be reversed and that the cost award entered against Connell post-trial be vacated. Due to my time limitations today, my presentation will cover focus on two of the four issues that are on appeal: the directed verdict on Connell's test section 3 claim and the directed verdict on the loss productivity claim. Turning to the test section 3 claim first, the standard for directed verdict is clear. It's only proper in the clearest of cases where reasonable minds could not differ on the evidence and no evidence or legitimate inference has been shown. That standard is obviously very deferential to Connell and its evidence in this case. And as concerns the test section 3 claim, Connell presented substantial evidence, including expert testimony, that test section 3 should have been accepted, or stated differently, that the engineer was, it was improper for the engineer to reject test section 3. That testimony included expert testimony from Dale Decker, licensed engineer, a gentleman named Trace Musgrave, who actually was on the ground when that paving was placed.
Pardon me, Mr. Correct.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Musgrave wasn't qualified as an expert in testing of asphalt sections, was he?
Mr. Musgrave was qualified as an expert in reviewing and analyzing those test sections. The trial court stated specifically in the motion in limine hearing that based on his experience, he was qualified to review those results and analyze whether or not the results that he was reviewing were in conjunction or compliance with the asphalt that Connell was producing on site. He was probably the witness at trial who had more practical experience placing asphalt than any other witness.
Okay. What's the precise language of the contract that you are relying on to provide a hook for the evidence that you're talking about that should have allowed this claim to go to the jury?
Well, on this particular claim, and the reason it was rejected, the test section was rejected, was based on this VMA standard. The precise language in the contract is that the VMA quality acceptance standard is 14.0. So our evidence was that the test section passed the VMA test of 14.0. Our tests were higher than that 14.0 standard. So that's specifically the standard in the contract. The contract also contains, obviously, that clause that says all work shall be in reasonably close conformity with the contract. Our evidence was that, one, we met the 14.0, and if we didn't, we certainly were within reasonably close conformity, and we could have been accepted under that standard as well.
How do you deal with the language in that section which talks about that the product has to be equal to or better than intended by the requirements of the contract? And was there any evidence in the record from any witness who said that your test showed that the product was equal or better than what the engineer was requiring?
Yes, there was, Your Honor. Our evidence was that our test results passed. Again, we produced numerous documentary evidence that showed that our tests were 14 or higher, and those were cited in our briefs. We also retested that same section, and those tests were 14.0 or higher. So clearly, if it's 14.0, if we've met the standard in the contract, then we are equal to or better than what the contract intends, because we've met that standard.
Didn't the contract give the engineer the authority to do the quality acceptance testing? Wasn't that actually written into the contract?
Under the contract, the engineer was the quality acceptance tester. That's correct.
And his test didn't meet the 14 standard, correct?
So the test that he relied on, he said, did not meet the 14.0 standard. We, again, had tests that did meet that, and we presented evidence that would call his tests into question, namely evidence that our test results should have produced asphalt, or tests that go this direction, and his test results were going that direction. So we did have some evidence calling those into question.
Contract gave him that exclusive right to make that decision. How do you avoid the results of that contract?
Well, as we cited to in the briefs, Your Honor, there is, if that is a discretionary provision in the contract that the engineer used and exercised that discretion unfairly or in contravention of standard industry practices, then that can be a breach of the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing. And that was also part of our evidence at trial, that if he exercised his discretion wrongfully to reject work that was either acceptable or that was in reasonably close conformity, that could have been a breach of the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing.
If I may, Mr.
Yes.
And if I'm mispronouncing your name, please correct.
It's correct.
I am sorry, and I apologize for that. It's important to get such things right. The engineering firm did quality acceptance testing, right?
Correct.
The 14 point or better results that you are talking about were quality control testing, right?
That's correct.
So it was a different kind of test.
It was the same exact test conducted by a different entity, but the same test.
Well, are you telling me that there was no difference in the testing process at all?
Again, it was tested by different personnel and different people, but if assuming both companies followed the standard protocol for that test, then there was no difference in testing procedures. They were both doing Marshall testing.
So other than use of different words, is there any difference between quality acceptance testing and quality control testing?
There is, Your Honor. The contract contains a quality program, and both the QA and the QC are important elements of that quality program. The QC, the quality control, is used to ensure that the product being produced meets the requirements of the contract. The QA is the test that's used to determine payment. So other than that, and the differences under the contract, the way they operate, there's really no difference, certainly, in the way the tests are conducted. But they are complementary, and there's certainly nothing in the contract that says one test counts and the other one doesn't, or accept these results to the exclusion of the other results.
Well, but I'm sort of curious. Why not have QA testing done by your expert?
Why not have QA testing?
Yeah.
Well, the contract had separated those as to who was going to do the QA and the
okay.
QC.
But in this case, if the results that the contract relied on for the decision for the engineering firm were QA results, and you don't give QA results, I understand you say that these are essentially the same, but you're not doing QA testing. Why not do QA testing?
That's the way the contract functions. The tests conducted by Carter Burgess were to be the tests that were used for payment. Our tests were to complement those and in our, according to our evidence, make sure that the QA testing was done correctly. And that's exactly what our evidence was. We had QA, QC tests to compare to the QA tests to make sure that the QA tests were reliable, and when the engineer relied on those for payment, that those were valid tests. And we produced evidence at trial that the jury should have been able to consider in determining whether those QA tests that the engineer was relying on were accurate and acceptable.
So help me out. Under the contract, were you obligated to do these quality control tests regardless of what the results were of the quality acceptance tests?
Yes, Your Honor. That was our program, and that was our responsibility under the contract.
So if all of the quality acceptance tests had come back and said you passed with flying colors, would you still have been obligated to do these quality control tests?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
Since I'm moving a little light on time here, let me move to the productivity directed verdict, please. Again, under the standard that Connell was only required to produce evidence from which the jury could have found in its favor, it was error for the court to dismiss that productivity loss claim as well. The county relies on Centra Jones as the basis for the court's rejection of the productivity loss claim. I think the Centra Jones case is clearly distinguishable. In Centra Jones, the court concluded that the city of plaintiff in that case had failed to apportion damages between two elements of its claim that were legally unrecoverable. Connell did not have any such issues in its case here. The court in Central Jones said that the city had betterment damages in its claim that were legally unrecoverable, and it also had damages that were caused by another party. And therefore, the court held that there was no way for the jury to even award the plaintiff the entirety of its damages. Our case is different. Our case was that the county was the sole and only cause of our damages, and we didn't have any betterment. Under the facts of our case, the jury certainly could have awarded 100% of our productivity losses.
How would the jury figure out if it wanted to award less than 100%?
There was some evidence, Your Honor, that the jury could have used to award less than 100%. Mr. Caruso was the expert who testified at trial. He testified regarding productivity impacts between 2005 and 2006. Specifically, if the court would please look at Exhibits 166 and 168, those were presented as demonstratives during trial, and that breaks out 2005 productivity impacts in terms of the number of days from 2006. If the jury wanted to break that out, they could have potentially used that as a guide to do it. There was a lot of other evidence in trial that perhaps the jury could have used to break that out, but I'm not sure that, and the county hasn't pointed to any legal requirement that required us to provide the jury with the basis that they claim was needed in order for them to break that out into the four components. The jury certainly could have awarded us 100%, a percentage of our damages based on its discretion, or zero if it found that we hadn't met the elements of our claim. I will reserve the rest of my time. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Grant. You've got about 2 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. I'm Daniel Gross, registration 12297, here on behalf of Rauch County. With me at council table are Mr. Pink and Ms. Potter. This case, in its simplest form, is a breach of contract case. When you evaluate the briefing, Rauch County has succeeded in laying out the elements of breach claims and demonstrating why the claims that were not permitted to go to the jury should not have been to the jury, because there was a lack of proof on a critical element. I'll get to those in due course. Also lacking in the briefing from Connell is any reference to the holding that the jury had on the seven claims that did go to the jury. And as I'll explain, there's considerable overlap, particularly with respect to the loss of productivity claim, which I'll turn to now. The loss of productivity claim should be upheld by this court on at least two grounds. First, under the doctrine of harmless error, which we briefed, there has been no showing whatsoever that had this claim been given to the jury, the outcome would have been any different than the court's directed verdict on this. The basis for the alleged breach was identical to four of the claims that did go to the jury, namely the working day issue, soft spot, defective spec, and wrongful rejection of work. All of these generally have to do with Connell's contention that because it was working in cold and wet conditions, that its cost of doing that work was different. What the jury heard was the direct cost of those particular items, and the jury found that there had been no breach and that there was nothing recoverable on those. The claim which the court dismissed on a Rule 50 directed verdict was essentially those same items, but a slightly different element of damage. Connell claimed that because its other work was affected, that it had an overall loss of productivity, but the underlying basis for the loss of productivity claim is identical to the basis for the claims that did go to the jury. It was up to Connell to make a showing to this court that the outcome would have been different had this claim actually gotten to the jury. It didn't even attempt to do so. It didn't even attempt to address the similarity between these claims. Therefore, under the harmless error doctrine, this court can easily affirm. In terms of the merits of the claim, Judge O'Hara dismissed this at the end of the evidence, the loss of productivity claim, because an essential element of the claim has not been proved. Notwithstanding Mr. Corrett's comments a moment ago, there were distinct differences between the four categories of claim of damage that were included in the loss of productivity claim. Two of them had to do with work that took place at the end of 2005 when these wet conditions that are the basis of Connell's claim occurred. However, two others were in 2006 on an entirely different part of the project when the weather was warm. Therefore, as a simple matter of proof, those two portions for the airside part of the job, there was simply no proof that would have permitted the jury to find that a breach had occurred. Judge O'Hara was aware of that, and in addition, he was particularly aware of the fact that the undifferentiated damage amount was problematic. During Mr. Corrett's argument, the question was posed, how would the jury know how much to award for the, hypothetically, for these two items that had nothing to do with the proof of breach? And the answer is they would have had no idea. Connell, for whatever reasons, chose to not provide the subparts, the four parts that together made the $283,000 claim. But as a practical matter, the judge held it was an impossibility for the jury to look at this simple number and understand which of the four parts pertained to a part that they might not be willing to award on. That was a fatal legal impediment, and the judge correctly directed the verdict. If you think about the logic of the rule, which does come out of Centric Jones, the contract law in this state is, in order to recover on a breach, you must prove the breach. You must also prove that the damages were incurred that flowed out of that breach. And finally, you must show that there's a reasonable method for calculating those damages. It's on those last two points that Connell stumbled and was correctly had that claim directed against them. Specifically, there is no way that the jury would have understood how much of the damage pertained to the work on the air side. And theoretically, with the record that's before this court, virtually all of the $283,000 could have been for something that Connell had provided no evidence to prove, namely the warm weather work on the air side in 2006. The rule has good basis and was properly employed here. The court simply looked at the evidence that was before it and, exercising its discretion under Rule 50, found that an essential element, proof on an essential element, had not been provided and dismissed. I'd like to turn now to the asphalt paving issues, which are considerably more complicated.
Mr. Gross, if I may interrupt you, please. I'd like to ask you two issues, the same questions that I asked Mr. Corrett. The first is, was Mr. Musgrave qualified as an expert in this area? And the second is, if you would talk about the difference between QA and QC testing, please.
I will, Your Honor. Mr. Musgrave was endorsed by Connell to testify about all manner of asphalt testing. The court conducted what I think is fair to say extensive in limine hearings based upon objections we had to the breadth of his disclosure. The court, it's about a 60-page long colloquy between the court, counsel, court and counsel, and I can cite the court to the section. It would be CD1 beginning at page 6614 through 6678. Over the course of that 64 pages, the court severely restricted what Mr. Musgrave was permitted to testify to. He was a project manager, but he admitted that he was not a professional engineer, and he also admitted that he had no background in testing. Based upon that, what the court permitted, and you can see it through the course of the 64 pages, was that Mr. Musgrave could testify about the things that a project manager might know about. For example, when the QA test result comes out, does it make sense to me as a guy who's running the batch plant? However, what he was specific about was that Mr. Musgrave was not qualified to render any opinions as to whether any test was right or any test was wrong. So it's a long answer to your question, Judge, but there were severe restrictions placed on what Mr. Musgrave was permitted to testify about. And I apologize, the second question.
The second one is the difference between the QA and QC testing as set forth in the contract.
QA governs in this contract. It is clear that the acceptability of work will be determined based upon the QA testing results. QC is undertaken by the contractor as work progresses so that the contractor can have some understanding of whether they're doing the work right. For example, if a big lot of earth is being placed, you don't want to be 10 or 20,000 yards into the earthwork placement to realize that it's going to fail the QA test. So under the contract regime that Mr. Corrett alluded to, there's an overall quality scheme that involves quality control testing. As pertains to the QC testing that we're talking about for test section 3, my recollection is there was no requirement whatsoever for QC testing. Connell Resources voluntarily hired a company by the name of EEC to come up and do that, and at that point they voluntarily did that. But the QC testing that we're talking about for test section 3 really had nothing to do with anything that was required by the contract.
Separate and apart from whether it was required by the contract or what the purposes were, is there any substantive difference between the tests that were done, or were they identical tests and one just happened to reach one result and one just happened to reach the other? Or is there actually a difference between the testing?
There is not. The answer is there are ASTM protocols that dictate how these tests are going to be performed. However, the practical reality is there will be what is known as lab-to-lab variability. So two labs can take the same sample, conduct the same test, and have slightly different test results. And that actually goes to one of the really central points in this case, which is you can't use one lab's results and then switch to another's because there's inherent difference. And that's why it's so important that the QA lab be established in the beginning. It's a baseline that everybody knows about, and it's a standard that everyone works to.
Contract clearly set forth that QA testing was to govern in this circumstance, so thus the engineering firm's QA test.
Correct. And that was conceded by Connell's experts. It's in the contract, and that was the position that the Carter Burgess engineers testified to as well.
How do you respond to the argument that Carter Burgess had a conflict of interest
because he's the engineer on the
project and
doing the approval of the testing?
Several points to that, Your Honor. First, it was understood by all parties going into this contract that Carter Burgess would play that role. Second, it's well known throughout the industry, particularly for DOTs, Departments of Transportation, that the owner can provide his own quality assurance.
Is that in the record anywhere, what you just said?
It is. Mr. Decker testified to it. Finally, the whole essence of this is some kind of demonstration by Connell that there were actually test results that were given that were in error, and that's what's really lacking in the record here. When you examine carefully what Connell's experts said,
neither Mr. Decker nor Mr. Fife was able to come out and say, these two of hundreds, literally two of hundreds of tests that were challenging were wrong. What you would expect in this case, and this would require expert testimony, this is not something that the jury can infer, is because this value is too high and this value is too low. I mean, there are eight basic parameters in this spec. We can show that there is an internal inconsistency. That was never done, and in fact, Mr. Fife, who was the QC engineer for the testing lab that Connell hired, Mr. Fife observed Carter Burgess's operation, determined that it was being conducted properly, and that the tester was doing his job right. I mean, there was back and forth in order to pin down if there was a problem. No one on the Connell side was able to say these tests are being done wrong. That just didn't happen. And under the Park List case that we cited to you, this is exactly the type of evidence that Connell needed to have an expert testify to. Very complicated stuff. In Exhibit 304, the specifications, the spec for this airside paving begins at page 242 and runs 20 pages. If the court hasn't had an opportunity to look at it, I would encourage you to. This is extremely technical, and there is no way that a jury from the fragments of evidence that Connell is citing to you could reach a reasonable inference that these tests were done wrong or under the test for reasonably close conformity that this asphalt paving was equal to or better than the intended specification that wasn't met.
Mr. Gross, I want to just real quickly go back to something you said right at the end of your argument about the productivity claim, directed verdict. You said that the court properly exercised its discretion in granting the motion for directed verdict. Is that the standard of review here, discretion, or isn't it a de novo question of law?
Before this court, it is certainly a de novo determination. The standard of review for this court is to look at what Judge O'Hara ruled.
We're not looking at whether he abused his discretion, are we?
No, what you're looking for is whether an element of the claim failed as a matter of proof because there was no evidence that a reasonable person could rely upon in order to find that it had been made.
Is a legal issue.
I would agree with that, and I think what we've succeeded
in. I think that's what you said in your brief. That's why I was confused when you talked about abuse of discretion.
No, if I've misstated myself, I apologize to the court.
Thank you.
Very quickly, the 40-degree issue Mr. Corrett has passed on, but I think that is clearly a matter of an expert who was attempting to render a legal opinion. Judge O'Hara gave a sauce for the goose, sauce for the gander holding on that, and said no one can opine about what the meaning of this contract is. That issue was also not preserved for appeal, and it would be a matter of upholding on that basis as well, but it was a correct holding, and unlike the other one, that is an abuse of discretion standard. So I'm out of time. If there were anything else that you were interested in, I'm sorry there's no more time, but we would ask that this court affirm in all respects. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Grupp. Mr. Corrett, if you want it, you've got just about 2 minutes.
Thank you,
Your Honor. Briefly on the issue of Mr. Musgrave's qualifications, I'd like to remind the court, Mr. Musgrave was a trained engineer, has an undergraduate degree in engineering, and as the court specifically stated during the motion in limine hearing, something to the effect of he may not be a licensed engineer, but he reads these tests every day and he knows what they mean. In addition, Connell presented more than Mr. Musgrave's testimony regarding the testing issue and the QA issue. We presented testimony from Mr. Decker and Mr. Fife, who were both licensed engineers who clearly were qualified, and both of whom opined that the rejection of that airside asphalt on test section 3 was wrongful.
But they never said that the QA tests were wrong or flawed.
Mr. Fife, in his lab, which is Exhibit 56, said that the QA analysis that was being done was done wrongfully, and he recalculated those results based on the way he did it. And in our reply brief, I laid out those, results.
I don't think it's your fault.
I've laid out those results in that column there, all of them, again, that show a 14.0 or higher. Regarding whether or not there was a specific test that was observed done wrongly, I would note that these tests were done essentially in a trailer behind closed doors. It's not it's not the standard that applies here for Connell to show an exact test that was done wrongly. The standard is whether there was direct or circumstantial evidence from which the jury could conclude that those tests were wrong. And I believe, as cited in the briefs, we've certainly laid out evidence from which the jury could have concluded that. We'd ask that those directed verdicts be reversed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Corrett. Thank you to both counsel for your arguments. The case will stand submitted. We'll issue an opinion in due course.